Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Set free. American basketball star Brittney Griner is released from detention in Russia in exchange for an arms dealer held in the United States. Then, voting on equality. Congress gives final passage to legislation that protects same-sex and interracial marriage. And fighting blackouts. Ukraine's electrical workers risk their lives to restore power as Russia targets the country's energy grid.
To have a complete destruction of substations, complete destruction of equipment, I've never seen anything like this before.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Brittney Griner is finally free tonight after a dramatic prisoner swap. The women's professional basketball star had been held by Russia for most of this year on a minor drug offense and was starting to serve a sentence of 9 years in a prison camp. But today, she was exchanged for a notorious Russian arms dealer doing 25 years in a U.S. prison. Nick Schifrin begins our coverage.
In a penal colony 6,000 miles from her home, Brittney Griner walked to freedom.
What's your mood?
Happy.
Well, are you ready for a long flight?
Yes.
On a tarmac in the United Arab Emirates, the wrongfully detained basketball star in red was traded for a notorious criminal, greeted by a Russian official with a hug. The deal done, President Biden spoke with Griner in the Oval Office and embraced her wife, Sherelle, after Brittney's 294 days in detention.
Held under intolerable circumstances. Brittney will soon be back in the arms of her loved ones, and she should have been there all along.
So over the last 9 months, you all have been so privy to one of the darkest moments of my life. And so today I'm just standing here overwhelmed with emotions, but the most important emotion that I have right now is just sincere gratitude.
I never miss break any laws here.
Griner's been in Russian custody since February. She pled guilty and was convicted of drug smuggling and possession after Russian authorities said she landed in Moscow with two vape cartridges full of cannabis oil.
People with more severe crimes have gotten less than what I was given.
She was sentenced to 9 years in prison and transferred to a female penal colony known for torture and forced labor. Russia's legal system has a 99% conviction rate, and throughout, the U.S. called her trials a miscarriage of justice. She was traded for 55-year-old Victor Boot. When he was arrested in 2008 in Bangkok, he was one of the world's most wanted men. He was extradited to the U.S. and found guilty by a U.S. court of conspiracy to kill Americans and providing aid to terrorist organizations. He was so notorious, he inspired the 2005 film Lord of War.
10,000 Kalashnikovs for a battalion. Your stocks are dangerously depleted, Dmitry.
Senior U.S. officials say they originally proposed freeing two wrongfully detained Americans, Griner and former Marine Paul Whelan. A Russian court convicted him on espionage charges that the U.S. called a sham.
Russia says it caught James Bond on a spy mission. In reality, they abducted Mr. Bean on holiday.
But today, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the only option was Griner for Boot.
This was not a choice of which American to bring home. The choice was one or none.
David Whelan is Paul's brother.
What's your response to Brittney Griner's release?
It's great news. Anytime an American comes home from wrongful detention, it's a great day.
And yet I can imagine it's so difficult to see Brittney released and Paul not released.
It is. We are grateful to the White House for the trust that they showed us yesterday. They let us know in advance that this was coming so that my sister, my brother, and our parents could process this in private, essentially, and try to come to terms with the bitter side of the bittersweet moment.
But today, some Republicans criticized the swap. Senate Foreign Relations Committee ranking Republican James Risch said Paul Whelan should have been part of this deal. And expected next House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Texas Republican Mike McCaul said trading Victor Boot will only embolden Vladimir Putin to continue his evil practice of taking innocent Americans hostage. But David Whelan says the Biden administration made the right call.
It seems that they had come to an impasse, and whoever it is in Russia was not going to make a good faith deal that would include Paul. If the Biden administration had continued to wait, then they would have been prolonging Brittany Griner's detention for no good reason. So, I mean, again, it's not great for Paul, and it's not what our family would have chosen. But it's the right thing for an American president to do for an American citizen who is wrongfully detained. And if it means exchanging a 50-year-old arms dealer who's been in U.S. custody for, you know, more than a decade, I think that the harm is not as substantial as people are worried about.
Do you fear that the price that the administration paid for Brittany Griner raises the price for what they would have to do to release your brother?
No, I think for each of these cases, whether it's in Russia or Iran or Syria or China, each of these cases has its own requirements. And so I'm not sure that the requirements for Paul's case have changed at all. And I don't think that the Russian government would necessarily expect more. They obviously have certain things that they are hoping to get as a concession from the U.S. government, and they haven't gotten it yet.
And the U.S. vows to bring Whelan home.
Sadly, for totally illegitimate reasons, Russia is treating Paul's case differently than Brittany's. And while we have not yet succeeded in securing Paul's release, we are not giving up. We will never give up.
Whelan told us today the Russians were asking for a spy in U.S. custody to trade for Paul Whelan, who was convicted of espionage. For more on the man traded for Brittany Griner, we turn to Rob Zaharia-Shevitz. He was the lead agent in the Drug Enforcement Administration who initiated the investigation of Victor Boot and saw it through to his conviction. Rob Zaharia-Shevitz, welcome to the NewsHour. Do you think that trading Victor Boot for Brittany Griner was in the interest of the United States?
Well, I don't think it's in the interest of the United States, but I'll start by saying what I've said many times before. I have nothing but well wishes for the family, and I'm very happy for them that they're reunited with their loved one. That said, I think that there's some very negative national security implications from such an ill-fated trade. And the first of those implications, I think, is American citizens throughout the world just got made a commodity and have a bullseye put on them. I truly believe that we just sent the message that it is good business to have an American citizen in your pocket through a false detention or a kidnapping, because they may be needed for a trade someday, and it's a nice equity to have. And the second reason is I think that it greatly tarnishes our rule of law, which is one of our strongest assets that we have worldwide. And I think that by engaging in this type of negotiation, I think that we reduced a judicial jury verdict into a political stunt, much in the same way that Moscow has treated Ms. Griner.
On that first point that you made, that it increases the chances of hostage diplomacy, the administration says it has taken steps to deter other governments from taking Americans wrongfully, including new authorities, new possibilities of sanctions, and calling out other governments from taking Americans hostage. Do you think that's enough?
I don't. I think that those are all nice points to make. I think through years of sanctions in Venezuela and now Russia through the Ukrainian conflict, we can see the effect that sanctions have and how they can be controverted and outlived. And I think it just defies all common sense and logic. It's right out of the playbook of organizations like Hezbollah and others that this is good business.
And on the point of that you made about degrading the rule of law, a senior administration official said this earlier today, "We try to form all sorts of alternatives. We try to pay as little price as possible, but we think there is a moral obligation to bring detained Americans home." Is there?
I think there's a moral obligation to do everything in our power to continue to support those Americans and make every attempt to get them home. But that doesn't mean I don't think that has limits. And I think that we have to take into account the other American citizens whose lives might just be imperiled by taking such actions and the national security implications. You know, I'll also add that I think that we have to find ways to start discouraging American citizens from placing themselves unnecessarily in harm's way, whether it's a missionary trying to spread God's word, an adventure seeker that wants to see ancient ruins, or a person that's, you know, traveling to an enemy of the state for personal gain.
And we did hear President Biden urge Americans to take into account travel guidance by the State Department. How do you think this trade will impact the U.S.'s ability to work with governments overseas to pursue criminals?
I think it really hurt our stance in the world. And I think it's going to be very hard to take the United States at face value moving forward after some of these trades. We make incredible partnerships with law enforcement throughout the world. And cases and investigations like the one involving Mr. Boot are incredibly delicate and take a tremendous amount of resources, not only in physical resources, but in relationships, in trust. Some of these relationships take years to build. And we make great promises to our foreign counterparts.
Tell us more about Victor Boot. He described himself as the largest arms transporter in the world. How so?
I think what made Victor very unique is that he had assembled a private fleet of retired Soviet military aircraft. And he had reach that none other that I've seen was able to utilize to place this deadly cargo in conflict zones throughout the world where other people simply couldn't deliver. And I think that's what made him unique and made him even more of a threat, not only to the United States national security, but to global stability.
And finally, you had a long career in law enforcement. You stay in touch with colleagues, of course, who are still working in the Department of Justice and other federal law enforcement agencies. And I wonder, what are they telling you, those colleagues who are still in government, about today's trade?
President Biden's lost the Department of Justice, plain and simple. I've spoken to multiple levels, every level of law enforcement, to include the prosecutorial side, the investigation side. It's universally seems to be very disenfranchised, crestfallen, and quite frankly, I think that the Department of Justice has been lost for President Biden.
With all due respect, the Attorney General, at least publicly, works very closely with the president. What evidence do you have that, as you just put it, the president has, quote, lost the Department of Justice?
I think I have an idea of where most folks felt, and it certainly would seem that the State Department won this round.
Meaning the State Department believed in this trade and the Department of Justice did not?
That's my impression.
We'll have to leave it there. Rob Zaharia-Shevitz, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And to look more closely at the Biden administration's efforts to secure Greiner's release and the controversies surrounding Paul Whelan, who remains imprisoned in Russia, we're joined by John Kirby. He is the Strategic Communications Coordinator for the White House National Security Council. John Kirby, welcome back to the NewsHour. How is it, I think a question that many have on their minds right now, that the Russians had so much leverage over the U.S. that they were able to give us the United States back, in essence, a professional basketball player who'd been found guilty of a very minor charge in exchange for winning the release of a notorious arms dealer, someone who was considered one of the most wanted men in the world, and then he was convicted of a conspiracy to kill Americans.
Thanks, Judy. Appreciate you having me. Look, I mean, obviously, nobody wanted to see Mr. Boot be a free man here 6 years before his sentence was due to be complete. And we were acting in good faith with the Russians over many, many months to try to secure not just Brittany Griner, but Paul Whelan. That said, through all those weeks and months, it was clear two things. One, that they were treating Mr. Whelan separately because of the sham espionage charges that they levied against him, and therefore there was not going to be a way of getting Paul and Brittany together out. And two, that the only way they were going to accept Brittany Griner's release was by Mr. Boot. So this was the deal we could get. This was the moment that we could get it. And the choice was either we get one American home or we get none. And we felt we had a moral obligation to do what we could to get Brittany Griner back home to her family and her teammates where she belongs. And we're going to continue that work to get Mr. Whelan home.
Well, Americans surely are celebrating Brittany Griner's release, but another part of this question is we heard Paul Whelan's brother David tell our Nick Schifrin that the Russians were asking for another prisoner convicted of espionage in the United States, that there would have been or could have been a deal if that had happened. Why didn't that happen? Why didn't that take place?
I'm going to be very careful here, Judy, because we're still actively trying to get Paul home. And I'd really rather not get into any kinds of details of what the options might look like and what that might be. We are very actively working on this, and we're going to stay at that task. But I think you can understand why we wouldn't want to get into speculative discussions when we still don't have Paul and back home where he belongs. We still don't have an agreement to get him released.
When you say very actively working on it, it sounds like are negotiations underway right now regarding Mr. Whelan?
We have not stopped trying to negotiate for Mr. Whelan's release, and that continues today. And it'll continue tomorrow and the next day. Yes, we are in active discussions with the Russians still, even as we concluded Brittany Griner's case, to continue to work on Paul's.
Let me ask you about the comments from a former DEA agent. His name is Zahary Ashevitz. He told our Nick Schifrin just now, he said, in his view, what happened sends a message to the world that illegal detention and kidnapping of American citizens is a good business.
I think a couple of things here. First of all, we've taken a lot of actions to try to discourage exactly that hostage taking by instituting new sanctions, new visa ban requirements. We've also incorporated, as I think I heard in that interview, guidance to Americans that are traveling overseas about the detention risk in any country, including Russia. We want them to be well informed. So I think any nation that would come away from this trade thinking, oh, well, there's a license, I can just go do this, would be making a dangerous presumption, because we're going to continue to hold people accountable for this. At the same time, we need to think about the signal it sends to the American people that if you do everything right, and if you still get wrongfully detained in a country, your government's not going to forget you. And we might be having to make some difficult decisions, tough decisions, decisions that we didn't take lightly, like this one. But if we have to do that, if that's the only recourse, you need to know as an American that your president, your government, is going to stand behind you and do what we can to bring you home.
So what is it right now to stop the Russians from grabbing another American anywhere in Russia right now?
Mr. Putin has done this before, Judy. This is not a new tactic for him. And I think Americans that are traveling to Russia or want to travel to Russia ought to think about that, the fact that he has done this before, and it could happen again. That's why, again, we've got that designation on Russia and other countries, the detention risk. We want Americans to, we want them to go overseas, obviously, for pleasure or for work, but we want them to do so fully informed. We don't want to see, of course, another American wrongfully detained in Russia or anywhere else. But unfortunately, this is a tactic that Mr. Putin has used in the past.
I want to quote something else that the former DE agent just said to Nick, and that is not only that it greatly tarnishes the rule of law in this country, but he went on to say that it reduces a judicial verdict literally to a political stunt. Is that what this was?
A political stunt. My goodness. I think I'll just refrain here a little bit. There was no politics here. This wasn't a stunt. Judy, this was about getting an American citizen back home to her family and her teammates where she belongs. She shouldn't have been detained in Russia for 1 hour, let alone the 10 months that she was in, as the president called it, intolerable conditions. The same goes for Mr. Whelan, who has now suffered 4 years of wrongful detention. Now, this is not about a political stunt. This is not about abrogating the rule of law. This is standing up, actually, for the rights of American citizens at home and around the world, and doing so unapologetically. Again, we're not celebrating the fact that Mr. Boot is walking free, but we're going to stay closely. We're going to watch, be vigilant on our national security. We made an assessment before we agreed to release him. It's important to remember that he wasn't serving a life sentence. He was going to be out in 2029. So eventually he was going to be a free man. It's 6 years earlier. But believe me, we're going to stay vigilant. We're going to watch what he does. And if he or anybody else in Russia continues to threaten American national security, we have the tools in place. We have the will in place to hold them accountable.
One other comment that Mr. Zaharia-Shevitz made was that that President Biden has now lost the Department of Justice, that in the view of the people he talks to there, this was a win for the State Department, that the Department of Justice thought this was wrong. Is that what's going on internally in the administration?
The entire national security team worked very, very hard over many months to arrange to get Brittany Griner home. At the same time, they were working to get Paul Whelan home. They're going to stay at that task, the entire interagency team, and that includes people from the Justice Department. I can't speak for every member of the Justice Department, but I can say writ large across the national security team that supports President Biden and President Biden himself, this was an extraordinary, long, dedicated effort by national security professionals across the administration to make this deal and to get Brittany Griner on that plane on the way home.
Final quick question. Mark Fogel, 61-year-old teacher, American teacher, still being held in Russia. Any word on his fate? Is the administration actively working to get his release as well?
We are certainly working to try to better understand his situation. There's a limit to what I can say in this particular case for a variety of reasons, so I'm going to have to be a bit guarded and careful here. But we're certainly mindful of the situation, and we're doing the best we can to get as much information and context as we can about that individual's state.
John Kirby joining us from the White House. Thank you so much.
Yes, ma'am.
And now we hear from a vocal advocate for Brittany Griner and one of the most prominent voices in women's basketball. Dawn Staley is the head coach of the South Carolina Gamecocks and a Hall of Fame player. She coached Griner and her teammates when they won the gold medal at the Tokyo Olympics last year, and she's tweeted in support of Griner daily throughout her captivity. Amna Nawaz spoke with her earlier today and asked for her reaction to the news of Griner's release.
I cried tears of joy. Tears of joy. I'm like, my boy, I got a dog that sleeps in the bed with me. He was looking at me like, what is wrong? Like, what's going on? And I just told him, Brittany's coming home.
Why do you think you cried? Why do you think it felt so strong in the moment?
For 9 months, for 293 days, I thought about Brittany every single day. And I didn't get emotional. I didn't worry. I just prayed and I just forced myself to be strong for her because I know during those 9 months, she had to have weak moments. I'm sure she did. So I wanted to be her strength. And to be able to uphold somebody up for 9 months, to now know that she's coming home, it's a weight that's lifted that, you know, only the people who were in this journey with Brittany could feel. And there's no more room. Like, there's no more room to feel. There's no more strength to be had. It's just more of thankfulness. Thankfulness. Thanking God that he allowed this to happen for her and her family.
You wore a pin every day with the hashtag WeRBG. You posted about her every day. You gave interviews. You kept talking about her and making sure people did not forget her name. But you were part of a larger network, other WNBA players and coaches. And we should note that WNBA has a really strong history of advocacy and speaking out. Tell me about that network of support and that mission of coming together.
Here's what I've known. Like, and I can identify what strong women look like. I grew up in a household with a mother who was incredibly strong. And I always equated my mother's strength to having the strength of 10 men. And when us women, us strong women, when we forge and when we link up for something that we believe in, we know wholeheartedly that it's going to happen. So a lot of strong women, the women of the WNBA, the women in the White House, the women in all these organizations that advocate for people who are wrongly detained in a foreign country. And we can't do it alone. President Biden, God love him. I mean, he wanted this to take place. Secretary Blinken, all of those people, really, we lifted up in prayer. We lifted up in strength to make sure that they had the knowledge and the fight and the strength to do the right thing. And that is to bring Brittany Griner home. Unfortunately, there is another party that's involved in bringing Brittany home, and that's the Russian government. They decided that only Brittany is on the table, and that leaves Paul Whelan and his family in a position of what we were all in 9 months ago, but with belief and hope and prayer, the same God that brought Brittany home, we hope will bring Paul home sooner than later.
You know, Coach, I got to ask you, Brittany Griner is a superstar. She's a seven-time WNBA All-Star. She's a two-time Olympic gold medalist. And there are those who said over the past several months, you know, if this was LeBron, he would be home by now. Do you buy that?
I mean, I really don't care. I've never commented on it because all of my strength and all of my, you know, my desires to bring Brittany home were for Brittany. I don't want to compare. There are a lot of places in which things aren't equitable here in the States with men, women, or whatever, black, white. That argument is for another time. You know, we wanted to put all our synergy in the bringing Brittany home. Now that she's home, you know, let's have it all. Let's talk about it all. Do I think that if it was a LeBron, a Tom Brady, or somebody else, I think we probably be moving a little bit quicker. And that's not on our doing, you know, that's not on our doing. I do think it's all predicated on Russia and their unpredictability and how they operate. I do think Brittany coming home and them relinquishing Brittany has a lot to do with her actually playing in their country. And maybe showing her a little bit more grace than some other prisoners. So, I mean, I think you have to think about that as well. But when I say, you know, I pray for all of our prisoners, our American citizens who are wrongly detained or detained in another country, if we can get them home, I pray that they get home to their loved ones.
Coach, you worked with Brittany. You've coached her for years on the Olympic team. You know her fortitude. You know her heart. How do you think she got through those unimaginable months in Russian detention?
Here's Brittany's a black woman, and she's an outwardly gay woman. When you have to endure those two things in our country, it prepares you to be able to handle the ordeal that she went through, the mental fortitude that she needed to have to get through, and the people, her supporters, the people who were on the ground advocating for her, were lifting her up. So with all of that, allow Brittany to make it through 293 days. I'm happy for her that she doesn't have to endure that, actually being there. But we know there's a lot of decompressing, and there's a lot of probably therapy that she has to go through to get back to equal footing. And I don't know if she'll ever get back to that. So I do think her heart's desire will be pushed towards helping people who were in that situation abroad and here in our country.
Coach Dawn Staley, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
A lot of gratitude there, and you can watch more of Amna's interview with Coach Staley online at pbs.org/newshour. In the day's other news, Congress gave final approval to requiring all states to recognize same-sex and interracial marriages. It passed the House of Representatives with nearly 40 Republicans joining Democrats in support. On the floor, arguments focused on protecting marriage rights against a conservative Supreme Court versus protecting religious freedoms.
The bill betrays our country's commitment to the fundamental right of religious liberty by depriving religious and faith-based organizations of their tax-exempt status and depriving individual people of faith of being able to carry out fully their faith without repercussions.
It's hard to believe that today, in 2022, we are still fighting to protect the right for all Americans to marry the person they love. But the Supreme Court's actions this summer have shown us that we cannot take our rights for granted. No one should have to live in fear that a Supreme Court decision could invalidate their marriage in the blink of an eye.
The bill now goes to President Biden for his signature, and we'll have more details after the news summary. The House of Representatives also passed the huge defense authorization bill today, totaling a record $858 billion. It won a sweeping bipartisan vote, and now it goes to the Senate. The bill makes changes in the handling of sexual misconduct cases in the military and drops the COVID vaccine mandate for troops. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration authorized COVID booster shots today for children as young as 6 months old. The Pfizer and Moderna boosters target both the original virus and the Omicron subvariants. The shots will be available once the CDC gives its approval. Iran has announced its first execution of a protester who was arrested in ongoing unrest. He was convicted of attacking a security guard with a machete. Protests broke out in mid-September after a young Kurdish woman died in police custody. They have continued despite a government crackdown. Across the Persian Gulf, China's President Xi Jinping held high-profile meetings today with Saudi Arabia's rulers in a visit being watched in Washington. Xi was taken through the royal palace in Riyadh by the crown prince. They signed technology and other agreements and rejected criticism of their human rights records. Peru ousted President Pedro Castillo has appeared in court to face rebellion and conspiracy charges. He was arrested Wednesday after he tried to dissolve Congress and lawmakers voted him out of office. Today, Peruvian TV showed Castillo in prison garb listening to the court proceedings. Prosecutors warned against releasing him pending trial.
It should be noted that if freed, Mr. Castillo could communicate with government officials to hide or destroy elements of conviction to prevent the investigation of the truth.
Castillo's defense attorney argued that his arrest was arbitrary. In Germany, police say they are planning further arrests linked to an alleged far-right coup plot. A wave of raids on Wednesday detained 25 suspects and seized weapons at some 50 locations. Prosecutors say the group wanted to install a self-styled prince as a new national leader. Back in this country, a congressional report charged that the Washington Commanders football team and owner Dan Snyder created a toxic work culture with rampant sexual misconduct. The House Oversight Committee said Snyder, quote, permitted and participated in this troubling conduct. The Commanders called the findings one-sided. Hundreds of New York Times journalists and other staffers staged a one-day walkout today over pay and benefits. Strikers rallied outside the Times offices in their biggest job action in more than four decades. They gave out handbills, pressing for a contract to replace one that expired in March of last year. And on Wall Street, stocks finally rallied after five losing sessions in a row. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 183 points to close at 33,781. The Nasdaq rose 123 points, 1%. The S&P 500 added 29. Still to come on the NewsHour, Ukrainians brace for a brutal winter amid Russian attacks on the country's energy grid. How suburban zoning rules are causing rents to spike. Plus, much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
As we reported earlier, Congress today passed landmark legislation aimed at protecting same-sex and interracial marriages. Lisa Desjardins has more.
Thanks, Judy. Lawmakers from both chambers came together to cheer final passage of the bill, the Respect for Marriage Act. Today's move comes after Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas expressed interest in reconsidering the Supreme Court decision that protects marriage equality, following the High Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade in June. Looking at all of this closely is Kate Sawson, who reports on LGBTQ plus issues for the 19th News. Kate, how significant is this bill?
This bill, a lot of people are reporting that this protects marriage equality, and in some ways it does, but it doesn't codify marriage equality the way that we know it. What that means basically is this would make marriages transportable from state to state for states that do have pro-marriage laws on the books. But for states that have bans, you still could not get married in those states.
And that's to say, if in fact the Supreme Court does take the step of overturning Obergefell and changing kind of national law, this really would just make it a state by state situation. You know, Republicans were key in passing this law, but most of them voted no, many of them saying because they were worried about religious liberties. What are their arguments, and what does the bill say about that?
Yeah, the Republican talking points about religious liberty tend to be that there's a worry that churches will be forced to perform same-sex unions. There are religious freedom protections in this bill. They mirror the protections that already exist. So a church or a nonprofit that is set up for religious worship would not have to perform those unions. However, if you do have a nonprofit or a business that is set up and wants to do business or is accepting government funds, for example, a charity that takes money and is doing adoption services, it would probably be still subject to state law. So there's not new law that is created by this in terms of non-discrimination law.
But it's to say some of those nonprofits may have to recognize an out-of-state same-sex union if they want state funds.
That's correct. But that's still not different from the law that we are living under right now. Because we have marriage equality nationwide.
I want to check with you about this last midterm election. This was a very high-stakes election, and I wonder, what's your reporting on what it meant and what it showed about LGBTQ issues and politics surrounding them right now?
Yeah, you know, I think what we found was that even though anti-LGBTQ plus rhetoric has gotten louder and louder and louder, what our reporting bore out was that LGBTQ plus candidates won in higher numbers than we've ever seen before. So in 2018, we saw 400 out LGBTQ plus candidates run. This year in 2022, there were 1,065 LGBTQ plus candidates on the ballot. Equality voters are just people who come out and vote for LGBTQ plus issues. So they're a growing number of the electorate, and white evangelicals continue to shrink in numbers. So I think when we talk about all of this anti-LGBTQ plus legislation, we're actually seeing this as a backlash to greater political power of LGBTQ plus people, but we often miss that part of the message because it's not as loud.
Just as we finish up here, thinking about those debates, and sometimes we're seeing ugly rhetoric, sometimes more threats of violence across this country. Where do you think the queer movement is right now? What is this moment right now for queer America?
You know, when I talk to advocates and experts about this, what everyone tells me is that this is how social movements go, right? That that civil rights movements are often on this trajectory of anytime that there is movement forward, advancement forward, there are pain points along the way, right? And that we are in one of those pain points of backlash and pain. And so because especially transgender people are experiencing a moment of increased visibility, rights, and acceptance, there is a backlash to that. So it's a moment of incredible acceptance and visibility. And with that will come this really painful backlash. And it's sometimes hard to see the moment of visibility and advancement, I think, in that.
Kate Sawson, you can read their reporting at the 19th News. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
For almost 2 months, Russia has targeted Ukraine's energy grid in an attempt to sap and freeze the country's morale. At one point, more than 10 million Ukrainians had no electricity or heat. Special correspondent Volodymyr Solohub and videographer Pavlo Suhodolsky report from Kyiv on the cat-and-mouse game between Russia and the Ukrainian workers who are risking their lives to keep the country running.
They call them the new heroes, Ukrainian electrical workers doing the impossible, keeping the lights on despite relentless Russian attacks on critical infrastructure. Andriy Medina is the repair team leader and says for weeks his unit has been working almost nonstop.
We have been fixing the equipment that was destroyed as the result of the blackouts and the power spikes, but also as the result of the fighting that was happening around Kyiv.
They face a constant threat. Russia launched hundreds of strikes with Iranian-made drones and Russian missiles. And the crews are in the crossfire. Russian attacks have killed at least four workers of this energy company alone.
It's difficult. The staff is scared. When a rocket flies over your head or something explodes nearby, sometimes people just refuse to work. Not because they don't want to, but because their mental health is suffering.
Ukrainian officials say more than 500 cities, towns, and villages face power problems. Russia has struck nearly every major substation that routes power between regions. And now the country is running out of parts to fix the Soviet-era grid. Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba recently urged allies to send spare parts quickly.
And we need transformers. When we have transformers and generators, we can restore our system, our energy grid, and provide people with decent living conditions, which President Putin is trying to deprive them of.
USAID and the U.S. Embassy have delivered tens of millions of dollars worth of emergency generators. And late last month, the U.S. pledged an additional $53 million for the acquisition of parts like the transformers that run high-voltage power into home electricity. The U.S. even purchased body armor for utility workers.
This assault on the energy infrastructure, this assault against civilians in every corner of the country, is not normal and can't be normalized. And there needs to be an understanding of the brutalization of the country that is quite simply barbaric.
And it is constant. The workers repair and the Russian military destroys the infrastructure again. In a 24-year career, Medina has never faced such challenges.
To have a complete destruction of substations, complete destruction of equipment, I've never seen anything like this before.
According to the most recent estimates by the Ukrainian government, almost 50% of country's energy infrastructure has been destroyed by Russian targeted attacks. This means that millions of people all across the country are experiencing daily blackouts.
One such family is Marina and Alexander Moroz and their two kids, 13-year-old Eve and 4-year-old David. Marina showed us how they survive blackouts, some of which have lasted days.
We have candles, we have power banks for our phones, and while we have natural gas, we're lucky because we can boil water, cook some food for our kids, make some tea or some soup.
But the real challenge is David's inhaler. He needs it for his heart condition, and the inhaler needs electricity. Marina tries to have him use it between the blackouts. Marina and her family brace for winter with the help of hand-knitted slippers, a present from her mother-in-law.
Our biggest challenge is the school. Right now it's online. Whenever there's a blackout, there's no internet, and it's a problem for both kids and teachers. Classes are often being canceled.
The blackouts are designed to sap the country's morale, and they're a challenge, especially because her husband works from home. But they're not planning to leave. When I ask why, she switches to English.
It's very important to stay our family together in Kyiv, really with my sister Mia and Dr. Sovdavid, and to stay home and help our country.
Even despite all the difficulties and all the hardships that this winter is promising,
I think this winter will be the hardest winter of our lives.
Cardiac surgeons in a hospital without power recently had to save a child's life using headlamps. Ukrainian resilience is on display at Kyiv heating points. They call them invincibility centers. These are equipped with generators, heating equipment, and some even have a satellite internet. People come to charge their phones, stay warm, or even keep up their schoolwork.
We come here because when there's no electricity, we can't do our homework since we need internet and power for our devices.
This center is a savior for these freshman students, who say they will keep coming here for as long as they're open. But Kyiv's mayor admits these aren't enough in case of a long-term blackout for a city of 3 million facing a long, dark, and cold winter. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Volodymyr Soloub from Kyiv, Ukraine.
The cost of housing has risen dramatically over the past few years, helping drive levels of inflation not seen in decades. One key factor is in many places, building has not kept up with demand. The suburban counties of Long Island, east of New York City, lag behind the nation. They have built less housing over the past decade than almost any comparable area in the country. After decades of fights, there are over affordable housing. Paul Salmon reports on efforts to push for more development.
A 14-acre eyesore in Huntington, Long Island, obtained by a local nonprofit to build housing.
Mechanical Cork, 146 units of affordable housing.
Right now, it looks like scrubland, no?
Yes, right now, that's what it is, and it's been like this for 43 years.
You heard right. 43 years. Pilar Moya Mancera runs Housing Help, the nonprofit which set out to build here when Jimmy Carter was president. Legal opposition and approval delays have blocked it through Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Bush, Obama, Trump, and Biden. Meanwhile,
the cost of housing on Long Island has significantly increased year after year after year, even for a young professional, because there's hardly any supply of rental housing. Right over there, you can see the sign that bus drivers are needed. And this is all throughout Long Island, not just here.
Though battles over affordable housing are a national commonplace, the counties that make up Long Island have a higher percentage of detached single-family homes than almost any large county in the country.
Where did you live?
So I lived on the second floor.
How much did it cost?
It was around $3,000 a month.
For how big an apartment?
For a one-bedroom apartment.
For young folks who grew up here and wanted to stay, like 27-year-old Hunter Gross, buying was a pipe dream, renting a nightmare.
You couldn't afford it anymore?
No, unfortunately I couldn't. You go have a good public high school, you go to a good university, you get a good paying job, yet the market rate apartments in the town of Huntington are pricing out young professionals who are making upwards of $100,000.
Where has the opposition come from?
So I would say a large part of the opposition are the NIMBYs in the town of Huntington and across Long Island. And these are people who don't want affordable housing in their backyard.
The NIMBYs, the not in my backyarders, determined to preserve the quiet suburb they moved to and make their resistance heard.
It is not just an issue of affordable housing. Even if it was exclusive housing, there are issues of density, traffic, and schools.
We have to talk about making it affordable for everybody. When this gets built and there's 146 units, that's great for the 146 people that are going to live there, but what about everybody?
Hector Gavilla, lifelong local resident and real estate broker.
Developers like to build, and if they could put more people in the same space, they're gonna wanna do that. And that definitely creates more high density and more people, and it definitely creates more congestion and more traffic.
But mainly, insists Gavilla, it's government subsidies to developers and lower income residents that taxpayers will ultimately pay for that drive his opposition to projects like Matinacock Court.
We don't have an affordability problem. What we really have is a tax problem. And we have some of the highest property taxes on Long Island. So all this is doing is just contributing to that. I'm okay with building any building as long as it doesn't cause taxpayers to suffer more in having to subsidize, because we're already suffering enough here by continuing to pay all these taxes.
Moya Mancera, though, thinks Long Islanders have long had a problem that precedes taxes.
Let's tell it for what it is. We do have a history of housing segregation, and there was a lot of fear, not only here, but all throughout Long Island.
Levittown,
a community designed for modern living.
It's fear with a history. In the 1940s, farms across the island were being turned into neighborhoods. The iconic community of Levittown was the model. Single-family homes built as a community the GIs returning from World War II could afford. People of color explicitly kept out. More recently, after a Newsday hidden camera investigation, New York State cited three real estate brokerages for discriminating against homebuyers of color. No surprise to Pilar Moya Mancera, who immigrated from Peru and eventually settled on Long Island in 1996.
I moved to a white upscale community. Within days that I moved into my house, I got a message on my door saying that I don't belong here, that I need to move out. I refused to move out. They left a second note saying that they were going to burn down my house.
No.
But I got a third note that they were going to kill me. When I received the third note, I was so pregnant and I said, I'm not gonna put the life of my baby at risk. So I told my neighbors, I'm moving out.
But enough convinced her to stay, even volunteered to keep an eye on her house, and she became an affordable housing activist, who finally sees more Long Island neighbors coming around now that they're aging as she is.
Now I don't have to go from being a helicopter mom to being an airplane grandmother. There is a place for my grandchildren. There is a place for my adult children to move in so they can live in my basement, right? A place for me to live for when I'm a senior citizen.
But just as important may be the cost to Long Island's economy. Anne Shabunko Moore employs 82 people making parts for the military on Long Island, says she could hire 10 more, has even lured employees from other states.
I paid their rent for a year, and then it was on them to find their own place. And
year here on you, you're paying the rent, and then?
Went back. It was the sticker shock of the cost of living to buy a house. Because understand, renting, even renting a place here is upwards of $3,500 a month.
So the CEO has a message for neighbors bemoaning density and taxes.
You all taxpayers are benefiting from my employees working hard, right? The number of employees I hire, the number of employees that are getting paychecks, buying food at all these stores, right? I'm your economic impact that's making this region successful. And I'm telling you as a business owner, my people can't afford to buy a house, right? They are going to leave. It's hard enough to compete for talent. Now I have to find someone talented and able to afford housing.
In fact, she's so desperate, she's looking for help from above.
And I'm looking at my roof, right? A 57,000 square foot building, wondering, like, obviously there's structural engineering issues and sewer issues. But I'm thinking, the footprint of this building, how many apartments can I put up there?
Right? Come on, seriously?
Come on, right? I'm thinking.
Apartments right up there.
I could, why not? Can I put a second floor on here where I can put 20 of my employees right on top?
Wow.
We gotta do something. We gotta find square footage somewhere.
Back at Matinacock, I asked the gas station owner across the street about the opposition.
Yeah, it used to be a lot. Now, I mean, I don't see too many people anymore against this project.
Because they need the worker.
Yes, and also they understand about how expensive of living in Long Island.
For the moment, the weeds still rule. But by early next year, shovels will uproot them, and 146 units of affordable housing will rise here. Yes, to Moya Mancera and others, 43 years late, but better than never. For the PBS NewsHour, Paul Salmon on Long Island.
Affordable housing, a problem all across the country. And online, you may have seen the stunning images captured by the James Webb Space Telescope. But just how are they made? We compare them to previous pictures from the Hubble Telescope on our website. That's pbs.org/newshour. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.